From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Why is the U.S. blocking an international criminal court? Is the Pentagon afraid its own soldiers will be tried for war crimes? We go to San Jose, Costa Rica to speak with Jennifer Harbury, who takes her case before an inter-American court, and international gay and lesbian activists speak out on human rights. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The White House yesterday blasted Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott, saying his backward views on homosexuality, comparing it to alcoholism, showed the Republican Party at its most extreme. The Mississippi Republican compared homosexuality to sexual addiction, alcoholism, and kleptomania. Other Republican leaders Tuesday defended him and supported his views, but Log Cabin Republicans, a gay Republican group, said Lott had insulted all gay members of his party, and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force accused Lott of feeding the intolerance that can fuel hate crimes. But Oklahoma Senator Don Nichols told reporters he agreed with Lott and explained the senator wanted to show compassion to people with problems. Asked about Lott's comments at his weekly news conference, House Majority Leader Richard Armey, a Texas Republican, avoided the word sin, but said, quote, "The Bible is very clear on this. Both myself and Senator Lott believe very strongly in the Bible." This news from Nigeria. The former military ruler, General Obasanjo, returned to his farm on the outskirts of Lagos after being released with eight other political prisoners, this according to his family. Obasanjo was told that he would be confined to Atta after his release yesterday from prison. The former head of state was sentenced to 15 years in jail in 1995 for allegedly taking part in a plot to overthrow former dictator General Sonny Abacha. In this news from Tokyo, in an exercise that the United States military patrolling between North and South Korea dubbed Operation Rawhide, the founder of the giant Hyundai conglomerate drove 500 head of cattle across the border to the north yesterday in an effort to aid reconciliation. Chung Ju Young, the 83-year-old founder of Hyundai, which makes everything from cars to semiconductors, passed through Panmunjom at 10 a.m., leading a convoy of 50 trucks filled with cattle from his ranch. The cattle will be hooked up to plows and used to work farmland in North Korea, which has been suffering from food shortages. Chung will stay in the north 8 days, visiting his hometown. Chung previously shipped 10,000 tons of corn across the border and plans to send another 40,000 tons during the next several months. With a visit by President Clinton just over a week away, a Chinese newspaper today carried a speech by a top government advisor warning Washington that warming ties could easily turn cold. It said China, out of ideological and moral obligations, can easily become an anti-American force. If you really want to make China your enemy, you will find that China not only is an unbeatable enemy, but is also a most unreasonable enemy. The man who made the speech is a top advisor to Chinese President Jiang Zemin. The newspaper did not say when he delivered the speech, but carried his comments as part of a series of articles about Sino-U.S. relations ahead of Clinton's trip scheduled for June 25th to July 3rd. Clinton's trip is the first by a U.S. president since Beijing's 1989 bloody crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators in Tiananmen Square. Senegal fired artillery into Guinea-Bissau, threatening a wider conflict and endangering refugees who have fled the capital to escape fighting between army mutineers and troops loyal to President Vera. Senegal has intervened to support the government. And President Slobodan Milosevic of Yugoslavia promised to make concessions to forestall military action by the West because of Serb activities in Kosovo. But he did not agree to one key demand, the withdrawal of Serbian security forces accused of attacking ethnic Albanians in the province. The United States and its allies said Milosevic's pledges did not go far enough to meet the demands of the West. that he end his crackdown in Kosovo and that planning for a possible NATO military intervention was continuing. The Ku Klux Klan plans a rally June 27th in the Texas town where a black man was killed last week when three whites allegedly chained him to a truck and dragged him for 2.5 miles. Jasper officials said Klan leaders said they wanted to disavow any role. And the Senate voted to limit lawyers' fees in suits against cigarette makers. Lawyers who took the greatest risk and were involved in cases before 1995 could collect as much as $4,000 an hour. But the allowable fee would drop on a sliding scale so that those who entered cases after yesterday could not charge more than $500 an hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This week in Rome, a 5-week UN conference has kicked off to discuss the establishment of an international criminal court, a permanent war crimes court with the power to indict civilians and soldiers as well as leaders of states, governments. Among the topics being hashed out in Rome is preventing UN Security Council members from undermining the authority of the proposed court. Already, the United States has come under fire from human rights groups and other nations at the conference for trying to restrict the power of an international criminal court. North Carolina Republican Senator Jesse Helms and the Pentagon have led a campaign to ensure veto power for the U.S., saying they fear American soldiers being brought before the court. The U.S. is just about to address the conference as we speak. We go now to Rome, Italy, to Reed Brody, who is the Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Reed.
Hello, Amy.
So tell us what is happening right now, and why don't we start off with what exactly an international criminal court would be and how it differs from what we're seeing at The Hague now with the trying of war criminals or alleged war criminals from the former Yugoslavia.
The tribunals in The Hague are specific ad hoc tribunals to look at war crimes in the former Yugoslavia in one case and Rwanda in the other case. These were tribunals set up after the fact by the Security Council to deal with specific incidents. This court would be a permanent international criminal court that could in the future try all cases of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, if possible, by whomever committed. So it would be a permanent court, not just limited to one area of the world. It would also differ from the International Court of Justice in The Hague, which is a forum for disputes between one state and another state, as when Nicaragua sued the United States or border disputes. This would be a criminal court in which the likes of Toto Constant or Idi Amin or Pol Pot could be brought before the court for their crimes and punished criminally.
And can you explain where the U.S. stands on this now?
Well, Ambassador Bill Richardson actually gave his speech this morning, and he really failed to clarify many doubts that concerning the U.S. position. As you reported, one of the big disputes is what influence will the Security Council have over this court? Will it have veto power? Will individual permanent members of the Security Council, as the U.S. has in the past advocated, be able to veto prosecutions? So that means that the U.S., China, and the other members could not only block trials of their own citizens, but block trials where their interests are at stake. Another question is whether or not states will have to consent to prosecution. Many states say that once you've ratified the treaty, that means that you've consented to any prosecutions before the court. The U.S. again failed to make clear its position. And what we're seeing is that the United States has a fundamental policy choice. Will it accept strong guarantees that all trials before the court have to pass a strict judicial test, that they only kick in after national tribunals have failed to do their duty? Or does the U.S. want 100% immunity from prosecution, as is being advocated by the Defense Department and by Jesse Helms? If that's the case, the U.S. is going to be totally sidelined here in the creation of the court.
Is it possible that we would see, say, a Henry Kissinger brought before an international criminal court?
Well, I think it's unlikely for a number of reasons. First, the U.S. is likely to be able, as I said, to be in a position to block that kind of prosecution. In the case of Henry Kissinger, you would have to look at his direct aggression, incidentally, is one of the crimes that may or may not be included. The United States is against including the crime of aggression. Many states are against including the crime of aggression. You would have to show, first, obviously, that there was a direct connection to war crimes, genocide, or crimes against humanity. But then it's going to very much depend on who controls the court, whether there's an independent prosecutor, whether the United States is in a position to veto prosecutions. There are a lot of questions really still up in the air here that's going to very much determine whether this is a really an independent court where you have a prosecutor who could go after anybody, whether it's going to be in the control of the states, or whether it's going to be subject to limitations by the Security Council.
How much is going on behind the scenes in terms of countries blocking behind the scenes, like the Pentagon lobbying militaries around the world to block the ultimate powers of an international criminal court, and how much is actually being said where countries stand?
Well, each country is now getting up and giving its general positions, most of which are already known. You have, on the one hand, the United States and France, who are furiously lobbying other countries. As you mentioned, the U.S. Pentagon has enlisted the world's militaries, the Pinochets of the world, to bring their weight to bear on their country's delegations. On the other hand, you have a very strong group of what's called the like-minded countries who are advocating an independent court with an independent prosecutor, not subject to Security Council control, not subject to the state consent regime. And that bloc includes countries as diverse as South Africa, Argentina, South Korea, Canada, all the countries of the European Union except for France. Germany is in the lead. Even the United Kingdom, which sits on the Security Council, has agreed that the Security Council should not be able to interfere. And then, on the other hand, you have the United States and France, but you also have countries like India, Pakistan, Iraq, Colombia, Cuba, Algeria, which really see this court as a threat to their national sovereignty, and are very fearful of an international system of justice.
We're talking to Reed Brody, Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. He's speaking to us from Rome, Italy, where an historic conference is taking place, a five-week UN conference that just began this week, which will establish an international criminal court. 153 countries are involved with this right now. Now, Reed, you're with Human Rights Watch. How involved are grassroots human rights advocates around the world in the establishment of this court?
Well, there's a coalition of several hundred human rights organizations, women's organizations. There's a very strong women's caucus here who want to make sure that the court takes into account the disproportionate impact that war crimes tend to have on women and on children, who want to make sure that a gender perspective is included in the workings of the tribunal and the witness protection programs. Most of the groups here are from international organizations that have the resources as to be here for 5 weeks in Rome. Human Rights Watch has 9 people here. But there are important groups from the South. There is the Children's Caucus, who are concerned in particular about the use of child soldiers as a war crime. There are people representing environmental organizations. Médecins Sans Frontières is here. So Amnesty International obviously is here in a very important way. Their Secretary General addressed the conference yesterday. And the Italian NGOs actually are here in force. It's become a very big issue. There are signs all over Rome by the No Peace Without Justice Coalition and by Amnesty International Italy. It's very much a live topic here on the streets of Rome, actually.
Reed Brody, I'm looking at a front page piece in the Christian Science Monitor today that says members of the Clinton team in Rome argue the UN Charter requires the Permanent Five to play a role on war crimes. They say if the U.S. increases its role as a world policeman, the Pentagon will balk if soldiers are more liable to prosecution for doing their job. They also say a free-roaming prosecutor could be at the beck and call of hostile political influences. Take an absurd hypothetical, one source said. On the verge of airstrikes in Kosovo, a UN prosecutor says that President Clinton or top U.S. generals are accountable for any civilian casualties.
Well, first, doing their job and committing war crimes are two very different things. I think we have to understand that this is going to be a serious court. The prosecutors and judges are going to be elected by a supermajority of the world's nations. The court will only be activated once national courts have failed to do their job. The threshold and the seriousness of this is going to be very high. And in fact, for the United States to be taking this position is throwing their weight around is really to not understand that the sovereign interest of most countries is a system based on law, is a system based on the equal application of justice. The scenarios, obviously, you can throw in any hypothetical you want. And I've talked to many countries here, including you take countries like Haiti and which have whose leaders have been accused by the United States of crime. Many people, obviously, the first thing they think about is what is it going to do to us? How are our leaders going to be affected? In many cases, frankly, they should be worried. But many of them have put this overriding interest above that, the overriding interest in a world in which atrocities are punished, in a world in which genocide is punished, in which war crimes are punished, above a small, the small and very remote possibility of politically motivated prosecutions.
Why is this conference going on for so long? I haven't never heard of a five-week conference before. And what role can U.S. activists here in the United States play now?
Well, because the delegates are trying to hammer out a treaty of several, which is now several hundred pages, which has hundreds of clauses in brackets, meaning that the 12 possible options are not agreed to. What U.S. activists can do is demand that the United States take, in fact, Lloyd Axworthy, the foreign minister of Canada, who spoke yesterday and who's been one of the leading proponents of an independent court, called on activists in the United States to get on their fax machines and tell the United States government that it is standing, that it has nothing to fear from an independent court, that it should stop insisting on a system on 100% immunity for Americans, because it's just going to sink the court. There is a homepage. Human Rights Watch has a homepage, www.hrw.org. The Coalition for an International Criminal Court, which brings together over 600 organizations, is at www.cicc.org. And they're linked to the other organizations, Amnesty International, which is working on this. And people can learn about the issues and can weigh in with their representatives. We believe that the U.S. has not made up its mind, in fact, that there's a dispute between the State Department, the Pentagon, and Justice over whether the U.S. is going to insist on 100% immunity from prosecution or whether it will put its faith in reasonable, strong guarantees against frivolous lawsuits.
Well, Reed Brody, I want to thank you very much for joining us from Rome, Italy, where this historic conference of 153 states is taking place, 153 countries, deciding on the establishment of an international criminal court. Reed Brody, the Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. When we come back from our break, where stations identify themselves, we're going to go to another court, the Inter-American Court in San Jose, Costa Rica, where Jennifer Harbury has brought the case of her husband murdered in Guatemala. Stay with us.
is ruthless. The trees shake angry fingers at the sky. And the people hunch their shoulders, hold their collars over their ears and run by. It's a cold rain, it's a hard rain, like the kind that you find in songs. I guess that makes me the jerk with the heartache, here to sing you about.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I am Amy Goodman. We now go down to San Jose, Costa Rica, where the case of Harbury versus Guatemala began yesterday in the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, the court of the Organization of American States. An international panel of judges heard 4 hours of testimony by Jennifer Harbury, who's suing the Guatemalan government for the torture, murder, and cover-up of the case of her husband, Efraín Bámaca Velásquez, the last Mayan comandante of the Guatemalan guerrillas. Harbury has been on a nonstop crusade since her husband's capture in 1992 to uncover the facts around his death. In the years since his capture, despite the best efforts of the U.S. and Guatemalan governments to cover up his death, Harbury has learned at least one of his torturers, Colonel Alpirez, was on the CIA payroll, and that several were trained at the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. Harbury, a Harvard-trained lawyer, has sued the U.S. government to release all information on his case and is one of the few to get a hearing in the Inter-American Court. Jennifer Harbury now joins us on the phone from San Jose. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jennifer.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Amy.
I realize that you're just about to go off to court today and the second day of a really unusual case that's being heard before the Inter-American Court. Can you explain how this case came to be in the OAS's court?
Yes, originally we filed the case in the Inter-American Commission of the OAS, which is located in Washington, D.C. That is not a court. It's like an agency for human rights. They receive the complaint. They investigate it. They receive new evidence as we bring it in. They can issue cautionary measures and protective measures to protect people who are endangered, but they're not a court. They cannot assess damages. They cannot assess punitive measures of any kind, and they cannot issue judicial orders. Normally, they process a case for as long as it takes to try to receive as much evidence as may exist, and then they reach their final conclusions and findings of facts and of law. Normally, the case ends there. In most cases, all we can tell the commission is that armed gunmen wearing masks broke into a house and dragged a certain religious leader, for example, away, and he was never seen again. But it's difficult to say who it was other than circumstantial evidence indicating the military, of course. In this case, the evidence was quite total, as we know now, and the case was remanded from the commission up to the court, which is a highly unusual move. Very few cases are actually sent to the court for a full international trial. The court itself is located here in San Jose, Costa Rica.
So tell us what you told the court yesterday in San Jose.
I was able to summarize all of the circumstantial evidence that I found about my husband's secret detention, torture, long-term torture, and assassination. They had already heard from Santiago Cabrera Lopez, the prisoner of war who was able to escape, who himself had been severely tortured from 5 to 6 months, and who had seen my husband on 2 different occasions being brutalized as a prisoner in the hands of the Guatemalan army in both the Santa Ana Berlin military base and also military base number 18 in San Marcos. The last time he saw him, he was being tortured by Colonel Julio Roberto Alpirez. I was able to then discuss for the court the part of the proceedings where I then went to Guatemala, opened the grave, found the original forensic report, and found, of course, that this person who was buried in the grave where they claimed they had buried my husband was in no way similar to my husband. He was 5 centimeters too short, 15 years too young, with 2 different metal caps on his teeth. And we proceeded to go through everything the Minister of Defense had discussed with me from time to time, their utter failure to be able to explain any of the evidence that we had found. The escape of 2 more eyewitnesses, one of whom was able to tell us who the body in the grave was. It, in fact, was the body of a young soldier who had been killed as a human sacrifice to cover up for the fact that my husband was alive and under torture. The other witness was equally interesting. He also had been a prisoner of war for close to 10 years, and he was able to come out and give us the real names, a two-page list of the real names of everybody on an internal G2 death squad that was also involved in my husband's torture and assassination.
And G2 is?
G2 is military intelligence of the Guatemalan army. This group is called the Commando. A number of their leaders are high-level military officials who also graduated from the School of the Americas. And they also coordinate 2 to 3 times a week with quote-unquote Uncle Sam in a building 2 to 3 blocks down the street from a U.S. embassy. When they arrived by helicopter to pick up my husband at the Santa Ana Berlin base, they were accompanied by a tall blonde person wearing U.S. combat boots.
And the significance of that?
The significance, not for this court, but for all of us as U.S. citizens, is that an internal military death squad of the most bloodthirsty army in the Western Hemisphere is coordinating closely with North American officials, quote-unquote Uncle Sam, and that we actually have North Americans going in and out of torture cells routinely, talking to prisoners, getting full information about them, paying for information they know is being extracted through torture, and then covering up and hiding the fact that they know where these torture cells exist and that people are dying there, and never turning these people over to the courts and never turning this information over to the courts. In other words, covering up the fact that these torture centers exist and letting people die inside in the most terrible of ways.
We're talking to Jennifer Harbury in San Jose, Costa Rica, where the case of Harbury versus Guatemala is going forward in the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, the court of the Organization of American States. Who will be testifying today, Jennifer?
I imagine that today, given the time pressures the court is under, it would be the human rights procurator of Guatemala, together with two Texans who accompanied me to the grave site in 1992. We were all thrown out of the country by literally 26 police carrying rifles and an official from the Guatemalan government. I imagine also that the forensic physician from the later exhumation we were able to carry out would also be present.
And what do you hope now will come out of this court hearing? You expect it to go through the week?
Yes, we're expecting for the evidence to be presented through witnesses and so forth through Friday.
And then will the court render its decision immediately?
It would have the right to do that. That would be highly unusual. Normally, they wait for the transcript and study it for a while and then write a lengthy report, you know, giving all of their findings and facts and conclusions of law. I'm assuming that we'll go under the usual pattern. It would be several months before there's a final decision reached.
And who are the judges on the Inter-American Court that are hearing your case?
These are judges from throughout the Western Hemisphere. Since this is a court of the Western Hemisphere, there's a judge from Mexico. There's a judge, I believe, from Colombia, one from Brazil. There's about half a dozen of them. This panel changes in composition from session to session.
And you were just referring to this, but what kind of effect can this have on U.S. Government policy? For example, your lawsuit in the United States for the U.S. CIA, the U.S. Pentagon, to release all information in the case of your husband, Efraín Bámaco Velásquez.
Legally, this part of the case, this case down here in Costa Rica, will not have impact on the United States government because the United States government is not a party to this case. The reason they're not a party in Costa Rica is because the matter is in a court proceeding in a civil rights case I filed with the federal district court in Washington, D.C. The OAS will only take a case if it's proven that there is no effective remedy with the internal courts of the country involved. In Guatemala, since they have shot at every single official who has tried to move forward one inch on this case, they've decided that there is no effective remedy with the judicial system in Guatemala, which in itself is a very serious finding. If the courts were to fail in the United States, then we could bring that case, that part of the case, to Costa Rica as well. But for the time being, we have to give the courts in the United States a fair and effective chance to proceed to justice themselves, which I believe that they will. De facto, an international condemnation against the government of Guatemala in a final ruling from so high a court as the Inter-American Court of course, would, you know, give credence and support to the notion that we really need to open all of these files on behalf of everyone else that is really represented by this case. This case, as I've said many times, is simply typical of the hundreds of thousands of other disappearance cases throughout Latin America. It's simply typical. That's a shocking fact, but it means that the relief we get in this case should send a clear message to the military juntas throughout the hemisphere that the dirty wars have got to stop.
Jennifer Harbury, I understand that a Guatemalan prosecutor who was supposed to be taking up your case, the case of the murder of your husband, has recently been murdered. Can you explain how it happened?
Yes. After we found out that my husband might be buried beneath a military base called Las Cabañas in southwestern Guatemala, we tried again and again with a special prosecutor named Dr. Arango to open that graveyard, that secret graveyard. He was shot at and put under 24-hour-a-day death threats together with his sons until he was finally forced to leave his office. He was replaced by a young woman named Sylvia Jerez, who is simply one of the local prosecutors in the town of Retaluleo. She was terrified at all times on this case, did try once to do an exhumation, and just gave up after that and pretty much said, "I can't do this case." In so many words, and the case just sat after that. She never did push it forward in any way because she was too frightened. All the same, 2 weeks before this trial began, she was driving from one town to another, and on a remote part of the road, her car was forced over by a group of hooded men. She was pulled out of the car and shot 13 times. She is, needless to say, dead. They also shot several times her assistant, her legal assistant, who then fell into a ravine and was left for dead. He's in critical condition, I believe, in the hospital still.
Now, this killing follows the killing of a Guatemalan mayor, which follows the killing of Bishop Girardi. Yesterday, the Guatemalan bishop came into Washington, D.C., who was in charge of the whole archdiocese in Guatemala City, and testified before a congressional subcommittee, New Jersey Congressmember Chris Smith, who has been doing a lot of work recently around the issue of international human rights. How does your case before the Inter-American Court tie into these killings? And do you think killings are on an increase right now in Guatemala?
They definitely are. They've been extremely high ever since the peace accords were signed, because what the army is saying to the general population is, remember who's boss here, don't get out of line or you're dead. We can do it and we will do it. Of course, the killing of Girardi being a very startling example of the strength of that statement. What all of these cases are about, including mine, is bringing an end to the official impunity that allows these military torturers and assassins to continue to torture and assassinate without fear of any repercussions. Monsignor Girardi died very slowly in his garage. According to a forensic doctor who was part of the autopsy team, it took 15 to 30 minutes for him to actually die by drowning on his own blood. He was bludgeoned in the face nearly 17 times with a slab of concrete. They methodically broke his eye sockets, his nose, his cheekbones, his jaw, et cetera, et cetera. He did not die quickly, as people had earlier thought and hoped. This was a torture. This was an assassination. This was an extreme political statement to all members of the Guatemalan public, not to think that anything had really changed in Guatemala under the peace accords. What this case is about, like all the other human rights cases, is no more impunity. Put the killers in prison or they will keep killing us.
I also understand that there is a level of rape going on in Guatemala that is definitely going unreported in the U.S. press. People heard about some rapes recently. These are Maryland high school students, because here they were Catholic school girls who had gone to visit Guatemala, and they were raped. I was riding on a train and spoke to a Peace Corps volunteer who was very upset about the fact. She said that that's the only attention rapes in Guatemala have gotten. She said, at least this person I was speaking to, that more than half of the Peace Corps volunteers in Guatemala have been raped, and the Peace Corps has kept this very, very quiet, and that if you go to women's health clinics throughout Guatemala, that one of the major complaints of the women who are coming into these clinics, the Guatemalan women, is that they're being raped.
I have no doubt that that is true. I have no doubt whatsoever. The army has disintegrated into a roving band of basically warlords and mafia leaders who are carrying out a series of, you know, apart from standard drug running activities, car thefts, rape, robbery, et cetera, et cetera. And you cannot expect soldiers who were in an army for a long period of time and taught that rape, torture, and murder were correct and good and every right for them to have are now released from the army and still have guns and will not continue to carry out these types of actions. Of course, with the Maryland students who were raped, the two people immediately captured were two soldiers, and the style by which their bus was pushed off the road and people were dragged into the cornfields was very, very militaristic. Amy, I'm sorry, I'm getting a signal here that I need to leave for the courthouse, but I very, very much appreciate your inviting me to be on your show today.
Well, I thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us just before you go to the court. Again, we've been speaking with Jennifer Harbury. Jennifer, if you have a phone number people can call if they want to find out more about your husband's case and overall about Coalition Missing, the group that you have helped establish that is trying to uncover and get out all the information from the U.S. and Guatemalan governments about the killings of more than 200,000 Guatemalans over the last decades.
Yes, I would recommend people call the Guatemalan Human Rights Commission in Washington, D.C. at 202-529-6599.
One more time.
202-529-6599.
Thank you very much for being with us. Jennifer Harbury speaking to us from San Jose, Costa Rica, where her case will go before the Inter-American Court of Human Rights for another few days, and then the judges there will render their decision in the case of her husband. His nom de guerre was Everardo, his name Ephraim Bamaka Velasquez. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move to another human rights issue. According to a report in this week's Washington Blade, which is a gay weekly, human rights groups are disputing the findings in a recent INS-sponsored report on the treatment of gay men in Mexico. There's documentation for dozens of anti-gay murders and numerous violent attacks from 1990 to 1995, most of them carried out in the southern state of Chiapas. Local officials openly scoffed at charges that police did little or nothing to prevent and investigate the attacks. But international rights monitors noted that most of the attacks and murders were carried out with weaponry known to be available only from police and state security forces. The INS-sponsored report says the situation has improved. There have been no further reports that homosexuals have been murdered with the apparent complicity or tolerance of government authorities, a finding that's vehemently disputed by human rights groups. In just a moment, we'll be speaking with a gay human rights activist from Mexico, as well as human rights activists from Indonesia and Israel, who just recently were awarded international human rights prizes in New York. We'll go to them in just a minute after stations identify themselves. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
It's ruthless, the trees shake, angry fingers at the sky. And the people hunch their shoulders, hold their collars over their ears and run by. It's a cold rain, it's a hard rain, like the kind that you find in songs. I guess that makes me the jerk with the heartache, here to sing to you about how I've been done wrong.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Just a few weeks ago, an international gay and lesbian organization awarded Human Rights Awards, the 1998 Philippa D'Souza Awards given by the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, which is based in San Francisco, gave awards to two people and one group, to Dr. Tal Yarus Hakak of Israel, a founding member and board member of CLAF, the Community for Lesbian Feminists, to Dede Utomo of Indonesia, who is one of the founders of Lambda Indonesia, and to Circulo Cultural Gay, which is a Mexican group, represented at the awards by Jose Maria Covarrubias. We begin with Dede Utomo, founder of Lambda Indonesia, the country's first gay and lesbian organization. I asked him what it was like to be gay under the 32-year reign of Suharto, and if he expects any changes.
I don't think there will be many changes in terms of people who have been able to come out to their family and to their society. In Indonesia, it's usually family and society and religion. Now, if you could handle that well, then you're all right as a person. Now, the problem with the, I would say, with the dominant ideology of the Suharto regime is that it is a dominant ideology of hypocrisy. You can exist as long as you don't say it, as you don't come out. But it is not, I mean, for any gay men, and especially for lesbian women, it is not a real existence because you really suffer the silence, the invisibility. So we think that now there is this new discourse of actually being open, being honest with us about anything, but anything at all that was never possible under the Suharto regime. I foresee that more gay men and lesbian women would be able to come out and organize.
What about HIV and AIDS? You are an HIV/AIDS educator mm-hmm. and coordinator of Gaya Nusantara, a mm-hmm. gay group in Indonesia, and editor of its magazine for mm-hmm. 10 years.
Mm-hmm. I see that HIV/AIDS is sort of a lightning rod for like sort of measuring, the way the dominant ideology of the Indonesian, well, of the Suharto regime had been, and that is that they've been. They have had all these double standards. I mean, they differentiate between good AIDS and bad AIDS. Good AIDS is that if you get it as a from a mother, or if you get it as a hemophiliac, then you're all right, and you could get help from the state healthcare system. But if you get it through sex work, if you get it through being homosexual, or things like that, then They do not approve of actually funding or services for people like us. But they're very shady in the sense that they will never do this explicitly so that we can actually take them to human rights organizations, for example. So they always do it through phone calls to funding agencies, for example. Do not fund projects on gay men. Do not fund projects on transgender people. The latest thing that they wanted to do was actually to even not fund projects for sex workers, because they thought they were only a small in number, and they wanted to do programs, let's say, for what they call good women.
We're talking to Dede Utomo, who is a gay activist in Indonesia. In 1997. Just a few months ago, actually, he was instrumental in organizing the third annual Indonesian Lesbian and Gay Conference. How did that go? And what were the major issues that you addressed?
One of the major issues was actually the issue of human rights and how to actually link with so-called mainstream legal political human rights groups and making issues around gender identity and sexual orientation relevant and to make them addressed by other human rights organizations. Yeah.
Let's turn now to Dr. Tal Yarus Hakak, who is founding member of CLAF, Community for Lesbian Feminists, which is a group that provides a social, cultural, and political focus for Israel's lesbian community. Can you talk about the issues you deal with in Israel?
We're the only national organization for feminist lesbians. We deal mostly with advocating, informing, making activities for lesbians and about lesbians and feminism. We do educational seminars for professionals in Israel, like for social workers, counselors at school about lesbian issues. We do activities within the community, support groups for women in the community. We publish a newspaper that comes four times a year. We have a theater group that perform in general theaters and performing lesbian theater.
One of your major issues, Dr. Tal Yarousakok, has been lesbian parenting. Can you talk about that and also adoption?
Yeah. Well, I raised with my partner, Avital, we have three sons. Our old son is probably one of the oldest ones who were born in Israel into a lesbian family from artificial insemination. And we sort of paved the way for many lesbian couples who wanted to have kids and weren't sure if it's okay, how to do it. We also, I appealed to the Supreme Court against some discrimination that the health policy against lesbians and the single mothers who were required to go through psychiatric and social worker evaluation in order to be eligible to get artificial insemination, while married women weren't asked to go through such a procedure. So we appealed to the Supreme Court and we won. And since then, the regulations were changed and every woman can go and get artificial insemination without any questions. Right now, we're trying to get adoption, mutual adoption of our kids. And this is also the first case in Israel where lesbian couples are asking to adopt each other's children.
Of the three, how many are yours, so-called, and her?
Well, they're not called mine, but I gave birth to two children, and my partner gave birth to one child.
And how is it going in terms of that adoption?
Well, it just began. Actually, we had a meeting 2 weeks before I left to the United States in the court, the first meeting in the court. And the states responded that they are not willing to give adoption. They will consider giving us custody if the social worker will give a good report on our family. Our attorney will go for the custody for now, but will continue for the adoption. And even if we'll get the custody in Israel, it's also a breakthrough. For recognizing us as a family.
Mm-hmm. How do you operate as Israeli feminist lesbians in the context of the whole issue between Israelis and Palestinians? And do you also work with Palestinian feminist lesbians?
Well, you know, I live in a country where outside wars always precede or postpone dealing with the social issues within the country. And our government, especially the current government, spends so much money on wars and weapons instead of spending on education and protecting human rights. Most of the women who are member in CLAF are very active in the peace movements, in the women's peace movements, like Women in Black and more. And our feminist perspective is that we are against any oppression, and not only the oppression of lesbian women, and not only the oppression of women, but also the oppression of the Palestinian people. So we are taking part of participating in any kind of fight that we can give in order to stop our occupying the territories. We don't have much contact with the Palestinian lesbians. We have one Israeli-Palestinian lesbian in our organization, and she herself doesn't know of any other Palestinian lesbians within Israel. They are very much in the closet. We have some good connections with lesbians from Jordan. And that's about it with regards to our personal connections.
How do you operate in a culture that is so much military defined also? How do Israeli feminist lesbians take on the Israeli military?
Well, it's very hard. We're debating always whether we should fight for equality within the army and demand that a woman will be able to do the same thing that men are doing in the army, or on the other hand, go to the other side of it and fight for non-militarism at all and not sending anybody to the army. Within the feminist community, we hear both voices. Also now there is a new struggle for the feminist movement where many mothers are organizing now together against sending the soldiers who happen to be their sons to the wars. Every day there are so many soldiers are getting killed. And women who were never defined themselves as feminists before suddenly realized that it can be a feminist issue, and that we as women and as mothers may be able to change things around and convince our leaders, usually men, male leaders, that maybe we can do things differently.
How hard was it to start CLAF, the Community for Lesbian Feminists? When did you start?
Well, it was very hard. It was 10 years ago. And I think that for lesbians 10 years ago, even 7 years ago,
was very, very hard to come out, to say to yourself, I'm a lesbian, because there was no network. There was no place to go. You couldn't open the phone book and say, oh, let's see which organization can I call and contact. So it was quite hard. We were quite pioneers in this sense. We started from nothing. And we grew tremendously. When I look back, I can't even believe how small we were and how big we are today.
How large is your organization today?
Two years ago, we were around 150 women, and right now we're over 600 women. And, you know, still, till these days, we're still operating from our private apartment. The phone line is in our house, all the databases and our personal computers. And it's getting to the stage that it's too difficult to do this from a private house.
Dr. Tal Yaris Hakak is our guest, founding member of CLAF, the Community for Lesbian Feminists. We're also joined by Jose Maria Covarrubias with Círculo Cultural Gay, which is a nonprofit group working since 1984 on issues of homophobic violence, violation of basic rights, sexuality education, cultural activism, and AIDS awareness, prevention, and education. The group is best known for its high-profile, dangerous, and effective work with and on behalf of threatened and assassinated transvestites and gay men.
We're known for an investigation we carried out related to the murdered transvestites in 1991 to 1993 in Tuxtla Gutiérrez, Chiapas. It was 24 approximately, most of them transvestites. And in Mexico we say, we call it a systematized and silent genocide against gays, transvestites. But in Chiapas, in Tuxtla Gutiérrez, it became much more frequent than other places. As a matter of fact, that makes us suppose that it was a targeted killing, targeted against this group particularly. One of our achievements was to put an end to that killing, which was too frequent.
Muy frecuente, y también el grupo es punto de referencia.
The group is also a reference point for when transvestites are murdered, for when they're picked up off the streets, when the press skews information about them or republishes yellow reports, sensationalist reports.
Why do you think Chiapas? I mean, here you have the site of the Zapatista uprising. Is there some connection?
Mira, esto fue antes de la insurrección zapatista.
This was before the Zapatista uprising.
Nosotros en el 92.
In 1992.
Hicimos una marcha.
We organized a march so that these murders would be clarified. That was November 20th. And in Tuxtla Gutiérrez, Chiapas, we got 20,000 people out into the streets. They came out to see us and to support us, most of them. So we felt an atmosphere of inconformity in society at large.
Claro que les gustaba.
Of course, they liked the fact that we were facing down their procurator general, and the people were complaining a lot about that, so they were happy.
Y como que fue un antecedente a este zapatismo.
It almost set a precedent for this neo-zapatismo.
Huh. When did you come out?
Cuando salí del closet.
When did I come out of the closet?
Yo nunca pude ser de closet porque desde
niño. I would never be able to be closeted because from the time I was a child, I was obviously gay.
And can you characterize the attitude of mainstream Mexican society to gay men and lesbians?
Mira, la ideología dominante tiende todavía a ser.
The dominant ideology tends to be homophobic and lesbophobic still.
Pero está viendo fisuras en esa intolerancia.
That intolerance is starting to show fissures.
Cada día hay más tolerancia.
And the tolerance grows day by day.
Hacia la cuestión
lesbian, not acceptance yet, but tolerance towards lesbians, gays, and transvestites.
Esto no quiere decir que se viva bien,
which doesn't mean we live well,
que no seamos víctimas
or
de,
that we're not
ese genocidio
victims of that systematic and silent genocide that we're talking about. That doesn't mean that people aren't kicked out of their jobs or that people are not denied access to housing. Of course it's denied. Of course they're kicked out of their jobs. And now it takes on more sophisticated manifestations. It's not because you're gay or because you're lesbian or because you're a transvestite. There's a special thing about transvestites. Many times they're sidelined and into prostitution because they won't give them any other kind of job. And if they do, if they give them a horribly paying job, preferably in the kitchen where no one sees them.
Finally, what has it meant to be honored in this way by the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission?
The fact that
we were awarded the Felipa de Sousa Award is further stimulation and motivation for us to continue doing what we're doing, the Cultural Week, the promotion and defense of human and civil rights for gays, lesbians, transvestites, people living with AIDS and HIV. It's a point of reference from the gay, lesbian, and transvestite community and for the society as a whole. We organized the Gay Cultural Week in a quality museum at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. We have 2,000 people turn out for the openings. Daily we get 1,500 people coming through there. And it gives me pleasure for it to be a point of reference, a place through which the lesbian and gay community can identify itself.
Es frecuente encontrar personas que dicen, llevé a mi mamá, o a mi
we frequently run into people who say, you know, I called my mom or my family, I went, I took my girlfriend. And when they see these spaces, these worthy spaces for us, it makes us feel good.
Well,
my mom, my dad, my family changed their perception of what lesbian, gays, and transvestites are. It's a point of reference.
Jose Maria Cosarubias, member of the Círculo Cultural Gay from Mexico. CCG is a non-governmental organization working since 1984 on issues of homophobic violence, human rights violations, and AIDS education. Jose Maria was along with Dede Utomo and Tal Juris Hakak. Together, they won the award from the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. I'm Amy Goodman. That does it for today's show. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!